This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Rolanda Watts, maybe you've heard of her. She hosted her own nationally syndicated TV show in the 1990s, and her fans know her simply as Rolanda. She began her professional career as a reporter at WFMY News in Greensboro, eventually landed in New York, a town that remembers her as their local news anchor during the Today Show. And from there, it was on to Hollywood. She did her talk show, also pursued dreams of becoming an actress, landed acting roles in TV and films, including a stint at Days of Our Lives. Today, Rolanda is still reaching for the stars. She's the voice of Divorce Court and just wrote her first book, Destiny Lingers. But it all began in Winston-Salem. Rolanda Watts, welcome to the State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. Well, I feel like I'm feeling at home with you.
I was going to say, welcome home. Well, take us, you're in L.A. now, but let's take us back to your childhood, especially let's start with your parents who were both educators in Winston-Salem, right?
That's right. My dad was the Roland Watts. They called him Sonny. He was from Raleigh, North Carolina, born in Philly, but grew up in Raleigh. And he was a fine artist. In fact, he was acclaimed as one of the best woodcutters and screen artists in the United States, particularly the Southeast region. He was the fine arts director at Winston-Salem State University. And he met my mom at A&T in Greensboro. My mom's from Greensboro. And my mom was the regional coordinator for early childhood education for many years and got her PhD at Duke in educational administration and retired as the associate dean at Bowman Gray School of Medicine, or the Wake Forest School of Medicine. But yeah, my mom and dad were UNCG graduates for master's degrees. Mom also got her second master's degree at UNCC, Chapel Hill. And got her, like I said, I got her doctorate from Duke. So
yeah, well, that can be rough on a kid growing up, right? I mean, all those educators in the family, you got to do your homework, I guess, huh?
There was always a ruler out, trust me.
And it goes back farther than that. Your grandfather was connected with Bennett College, right?
Yes, I had a great-great-great-grandfather who helped found Bennett College in Greensboro in the basement of his church.
Wow.
And of course, my family was about, well, are you going to go to Bennett? And of course, I chose Spelman because it wasn't in Greensboro. But yeah, education has always been, and you know, being from the education state, that was always around us. But I come from a family of educators. I had a great aunt who was one of the superintendents, first black superintendents in Greensboro. And so education has always been, whether it was freedom from the farm or just the way you walk in life, it was always so important in education. It wasn't about whether you were going to college. It was what college you were going to, So, yeah.
Well, talk about the neighborhood where you grew up in Winston-Salem.
I grew up in Winston-Salem in Woodbury Forest. Let's see, how do you describe it? I grew up in the woods with a creek running under our driveway, basically. Yeah, we were, my parents bought their first house back in the early 60s on Caledonia Drive, and then we moved to Fifth Avenue, and then, or Fifth Street, rather. That I went back to my New York days for a second there. Never lived on Fifth Avenue, trust me. Shopped there a lot, but and then moved to Woodbury Forest. We were the first black family. We integrated the neighborhood, and
that was something was very important to your parents. This is something deeply intentional in their lives.
Absolutely, integration. You know, it's funny because I when I write my book Destiny Lingers, and it's a story about interracial love. I tell young people when I speak with them, I say, you know, you guys can love anybody, anytime, do whatever you. I said, I'm in my late 50s, I'm 58. So I'm one of the last generations that actually remembers, you know, a segregated South, drinking colored water when it wasn't Gatorade, you know, and understanding the mores of our nation and the South in particular. But yes, it was very important to my parents that education was extremely important and integration was extremely important. Not only the integration of your gifts and your thoughts, but in the people that you surround yourself with. And that was very, very important. In fact, I was the first black to go to my kindergarten and was the only black at Salem Academy for many, many years, for 4 years. and in my neighborhood as well. And I think that was a very rich experience. I'm very proud to say that my parents and my family stepped out that way.
Well, I can understand that, especially looking back, and certainly from your parents' point of view, understanding the importance of being pioneers and sort of taking that step. But in the moment, what was that like for you? Was it were there uncomfortable moments for you, or did you find yourself navigating pretty well?
No, I have a deep love and insatiable curiosity for people. I really am. I don't know where that comes from. It comes from God, and it comes from good home training, as my folks would say. But I just love people, and the more different they are, the more I love them. But there were times when not the people got in the way, but the laws. Right. You know, as I talked about in my book, Destiny Lingers, the laws that tried to keep them apart could never separate their love. I had uncomfortable situations. I can remember... and I talk about this scene in my book, and this is a real scene, when I was in kindergarten and we were all excited because we were going to Tanglewood Park and we were going to ride the ponies and do all this. And I got a note that the teacher pinned on my sweater when I went home that night. And the next morning, I don't know why my parents decided to go see my grandparents when we had this big party planned at the park. And my mother later told me, I think I was 16 when she finally broke the news. She said, "You remember that little note on your sweater?" And I said, "Yeah, the note that was probably telling me what to pack for lunch and wear a sweater and all that stuff." She said, "No, that's not what the note said." She said, "That note said that this class is going, or the whole school is going to go to Tanglewood Park, but you can't go because the park doesn't allow blacks and Jews." And I think at 4 years old, you know, those were things that, you know, I skip up to... when I was at Salem Academy and the only black in the school, I never felt the prejudice. Never, ever. These girls are still my sisters to this day. And I can actually remember when there were parties, you know, the little prom parties with the private school boys at the one of the country clubs. And the country club said, "Well, Rolanda can't come." And my friends stood up for me. My sisters said, "Listen, we're not playing into the mores of this segregated society. This is our friend, and this is our Salem sister. And if she doesn't go, we don't go." So I've had that type of experience, too.
We're talking Rolanda Watts today on The State of Things. Well, and forgive me for interrupting, but you had some pretty high-powered friends, too, some names that people will recognize throughout the country who you were going to school with, right? Haynes and Reynolds among the few.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, really, just beautiful, beautiful women who... you know, we were girls at the time, and to this day, we are still the deepest of friends. In fact, this spring, we celebrated one of our momentous occasions. Can't believe it's been 40 years. and we went back and just talked about so much about, you know, the things that we did and shared and a deep friendship that was built, even in difficult times.
Let's talk about your decision to go to college. You mentioned Spelman in Atlanta, a historically black college, university. You talked about your experiences integrating these places, making good friends, but you chose a historically black college. Why?
Well, by that time, my parents felt I needed to know black folks. and just really understand, I mean, you know, when you're educated in the American system, you learn a certain education, and that's good. That's part of our history. But our history as a nation is so much richer than that. And at that time, back when, you know, half the things that were anything about the black culture were not included in the historic books of the nation, especially teaching children, it was important to my family that I know what my culture has contributed to this great nation. And, you know, as I say when I speak to folks, I say, you know, my little patch of this big quilt we call America may be of a different texture or a different hue, but it certainly fits. I fit right in here, too. And I think it was Spelman that gave me the rich culture that, you know, that I didn't learn at Salem. I mean, no offense, but I just didn't learn it, that, you know, that a black man did the first open heart surgery or, you know, he was a huge architect in Washington, D.C. and planned the way the streets are laid out or created peanut butter or the things that we just weren't taught.
Designed Duke University for that
designed,
matter.
Designed, absolutely, yeah. And quite honestly, much of what's in Washington.
Yeah.
But yes, that you do contribute and you have to continue contributing. Mm. that it's not just about so you know about these folks, but that you have a path to continue, that you have a legacy that's been laid out for you. As Dr. Maya Angelou used to say, my dear Auntie Maya would say, you know, your crown and all the jewels in it have been bought and paid for. Your job is to do what you are supposed to do with your gifts and talents. And I think that that is where, you know, it's not about bipartisan or biracial or anything like that. It's just giving your gifts back to God, doing what you're supposed to be here to do and to make the world better with those gifts.
Well, you mentioned Maya Angelou and your relationship with her when you were living up in the Triad in the Winston-Salem area. We'll talk more about that when I continue my conversation with journalist, actress, and author Rolanda Watts on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow.
All rise for Judge Joe Brown.
Whoa!
Experience, knowledge, and a passion for the truth.
I'm protecting womanhood and promoting manhood.
All this week.
That is the voice of Rolanda Watts, who has found a number of ways to bring people to their feet in her career in Hollywood. You may recognize her voice from the court shows Judge Joe Brown in Divorce Court, also scored a number of acting roles in TV and film, and penned a novel set on Topsail Island here in North Carolina, a place where she spent a lot of time as a kid since it's only a short drive from her native Winston-Salem. Rolanda, tell us more about Maya Angelou, who certainly lived and taught up there, and your relationship with her.
Yeah, you know, she taught for so many years at Wake Forest University. And my mom, who was there, was very instrumental in helping get her a teaching residency there. And we became very close family friends. I think for about 35 years, I spent many a Thanksgiving and July 4th and Easter with her and the extended family that she adoringly referred to as her village. And it was just a blessing to be under the loving wings, I would say, of the great Dr. Maya Angelou, who taught me not only about writing and about storytelling, but not dying with the story still in you, you know, doing something with those stories. And I find that that she was such a humanitarian. You know, when she was such an inspiration, I asked her one time, I said, well, how do you write? She says, well, you take a verb and a noun and an adjective and throw it against the wall and make it sing. And I thought, oh, my God, if I could just do that. And so
that sentence alone was brilliant, yeah.
I know. She just made it so romantic to be a writer. And I thought, by golly, I've got a story in me. I'm going to tell it. And when I showed her the manuscript, she said, I'm so angry with you. And I said, why? What did I do? She said, you finished it. And she said, don't you die with this story still in you. And I knew then, Frank, that I had a story of humanitarian integrity to share. Hmm. And though it deals with very rough issues such as racism and classism, it is embellished in the wonderful beauty of love with all of its complexities. And she was a big, big cheerleader for me.
Did she help you along the way? We should talk a little bit more about the book itself. It's set in Topsail Island, and you spent many of your summers at Ocean City Beach, which was a historically black beach, which I guess some of your family were some of the first to found that beach in some ways, right?
That's right. You're going back 1948. I believe the land was purchased. 10 black families got together, the Chestnuts, my grandparents, and other black families got together and dreamed of their kids playing on the beach. And at that time in North Carolina, you know, if you had a brown foot, you couldn't put it in the ocean off our coast. And that was a travesty in many of our eyes. And so my grandparents, these other families, and some white families, quite honestly, worked to bring integration to the island of Topsail Island, which had previously been owned by the military at that time. And we have great history on that island. The bumblebee fleet was created by a young man who sat on that beach and looked at a bumblebee and said, how in the world do you fly with your hairy, big, thick body? And got very aerodynamically inspired and created the bumblebee fleet, which helped get those tanks over to Germany and helped us win that war. So we find it a magical place. It's only 26 miles long and a quarter of a mile wide. And Ocean City was a small community that I spent all of my life, and my parents dated there. We have such history there. And I wanted to capture that history and the beauty of that island. We survived Hurricane Hazel back in 1954, totally wiped out the island. The only way we knew where our land was my grandmother's quilt was wrapped around a water pipe. And then I would be one of the crazy 11 people who stayed on the island during Hurricane Bertha in 1996. And this helped inspire that story.
Tell us more about the story.
Well, my novel, I love it that Amazon is calling it a romance suspense novel. Because, and the guys are really getting into it, too. It's not chick lit. I want you to know, people. I want you to know.
Okay.
But it's about an investigative news reporter in New York City. She's chasing down all the big stories, including helping to negotiate a hostage situation. And it's covering everything but her own life until she finds this long strand of red hair stretched across her husband's bed pillow. And the only person she knows with bright red hair is her best friend, Eve. And so that one strand of red hair unravels this whole, you might call it the red herring, unravels this whole story of deceit. She can't take it anymore. She goes down to North Carolina to this little beach community where she grew up to get her head together. She meets this very handsome police chief, think Matthew McConaughey, girls, and she's got this uncanny familiarity. She can't figure out. Come to find out, that's the little boy she was in love with, but she couldn't be with because of segregation. But time moves on, and destiny lingers. And it's like, what would you do at a second chance at your first love?
What gave you the idea for the story itself? I mean, obviously the setting and, you know, was certainly a big part of your own life, but the story itself and the story, the deeper themes that you wanted to explore, when did they emerge in your life?
Well, you know, tragedy makes such great drama and reading. And I was like, I know that, you know, when I, you know, I think that what happened was after the hurricane, Bertha, that I survived, one of 11, as the news called it, stubborn stragglers on the island.
Stubborn is polite for what you are, Rolanda,
exactly.
But okay.
Exactly. If anybody tells you to evacuate an island during a hurricane, leave.
Okay.
I'm telling you. But anyway, I had to eat at the Red Cross for 3 days after the hurricane, and we couldn't leave our houses. The police officers had to pick us up and take us to the Red Cross to eat. And this police chief was around the same age as me, and we shared so many memories, and I couldn't understand why we didn't know each other.
Mm.
And then we thought about it, and it was like, dude, we couldn't have been friends back then. We could have been killed. And then my brain started going. I said, look at the beauty of Topsail Island and that gorgeous ocean, but you sat through that hurricane, and the beauty and the ugliness of Mother Nature combined with the beautiness and ugliness of human nature, there's something there. And I had to get her in that hurricane, and I wanted her to experience getting a second chance to be able to choose love, if that was a choice. And then I had to think of something to get her down there, and of course I was still healing and reeling from betrayal myself, and put those feelings in there. So it's a healing book as well, but I just wanted to explore that. You know, Chase, my character, who so many readers are in love with, I mean, I'm so surprised by this. He's such a good guy. He comes from a trailer park. He comes from a difficult background. He's a poor kid in America. And here's Destiny, who comes from a pretty well-to-do family. But her parents are classist. You know, there's this one line where she says, he couldn't play with me because I was black, but I couldn't play with him because he was poor.
Mm.
And I've had white men, when I was on book tour all last year, went to 15 cities, went back to Topsail, went down to the Deep South, and I was concerned what would happen when we have these discussions about the book. And I'm just been so, I'm just thrilled and thankful. I'm so grateful. I've had people, white men, in fact, Frank, have come to me and said, thank you for telling this story.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, because there are not a lot of stories about humble beginnings for little white boys who made something of themselves. And I said, you know, I never thought about that. But that's who's angry right now in America,
yeah,
Frank,
yeah.
Is the little boy, you know, who didn't have those opportunities. So I'm really excited about the dialogue and the conversation that's coming out of this book.
Well, you came to it all honestly, and this really was in the midst of a career in media that actually began in Greensboro as a TV reporter, right? Tell us about your first days in reporting.
Oh, my gosh. As soon as I finished, after Spelman, I went to Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. And my first job was with WFMY, the CBS affiliate, in Greensboro. And at that time, I mean, I was really excited because it was such a changing time in America, but in North Carolina in particular. I was the cub reporter, and of course they sent me out to do the craziest stories, just trying to break me. And it had rained for 3 days straight, I think, and then it stopped. And my job was go out and tell the story about the effects of the rain when all the puddles had dried up, the ducks had gone home. And I was like, I don't have a story. Until we pulled over by a tobacco field and I saw those leaves rustling. I'd never seen anything move that fast in a tobacco field. And come to find out there were new migrant workers coming to North Carolina to help us with tobacco. The farmer's sons wanted to leave and go to big cities, you know.
So this would have been what year?
This was back in 1980,
81. Okay, all right.
And the migrant workers were coming in to save the tobacco field.
Right.
And so I did this story. I said, there's a new face. There's a new language being spoken in our tobacco fields, but it's helping save an economy. And we got a three-piece special on it and really did some fun stuff. I mean, I did a lot of bridge referendums and stuff like that, teddy bear festivals at the, you know. But some of the stories that were coming out at that time were so important, you know. And then I went on to New Jersey Network, where I was one of the first duo women anchor teams and a reporter, and then on to WNBC and WABC, being an investigative news reporter and producer and anchor woman. And at that time, it was so exciting because there were stories nobody was touching, like pedophilia. I broke one of the first stories on child molestation, stories about AIDS and homelessness, things people didn't want to talk about back then. They were like, nobody wants to talk about that during dinner. Mm. But these were important issues to save our children and save our lives.
What was it like for you? You'd obviously been away. You'd gone to Spelman. You went to school in New York. So it's not like you're just coming from North Carolina and then suddenly you're at WNBC or CBS in New York. What was it? Was it an adjustment for you to work in that environment? Or was it, you know, I mean, I guess it's competitive wherever you are. So maybe it wasn't that much of an adjustment.
You know something? I'm going to be honest with you. I was always a fast talker, fast walker, dream bigger. You know, I was like the ballistic missile in North Carolina. People would say, oh, my God, where did she come from? Who is this? My dad called me Little It because he couldn't figure out what in the world. So I think, you know, every year my family, we would spend the summers. A lot of times I was in summer school or, you know, doing something in the community or do it an internship, something. And then I would go to camp and I went to Sherwood Forest day camp and, you know, became a camp counselor. Loved that place. And my family would go. I would spend time on the farm where my mother's family had land. And then I'd spend time at the beach with my father's family. But it was going to New York at the end of the summer as a family trip that turned my life around. It was the place that, wow, people walked as fast, they talked as loud, they moved as fast, they had these crazy ideas and defended them. I love this place. And so I wore this little Subway token around my neck. Back in the day, you might recall, they had a big Y in the middle that was open. And my dad bought me this gold chain, and I would rub that thing, that little token, with steel, that steel wool until it shined like 18 karat gold. And I wore that thing around my neck as a hope, you know, like a touchstone. And on one side it said New York City, and on the other side it said good for one fare. And I said, I'm going to New York. I got to get there. So, yes, I had everybody in the newsroom going, y'all.
There you go.
I never lost my Southern accent. I had to learn it's cement, not cement.
Cement. Well, if you can get him to say might could, you've done it all then. But let's talk about, you know, now that I've got you and thinking about being in newsrooms back then and now looking at the Me Too movement when much has emerged and, you know, we understand what was going on then and women found it, for reasons that I think we can all understand, so difficult to come forward. What was it like for you in that environment back then?
You know, I was very blessed in the newsrooms to have really decent people. You know, back then, integrity was so much a part of what we did. I was blessed and lucky. I know there maybe other people weren't. I'm a tough cookie. I'm not an easy one that you're going to try to come play some games with, to be honest with you. I can say that I am part of the, I do have a couple of Me Too experiences. You know, I was in college and working at a radio station, and a woman was putting a lot of pressure on me. And thank God I could just leave because I was in you know, young and moving. I didn't have to stay there. Wasn't like, if I didn't do this, I would be in trouble for my career. I could leave. Yeah. I also remember being a consultant for a major foundation, and the man saying something to me and threatening to take my money. And then I threatened if he didn't pay me more because of the incident, then I was going to take it public. Mm-hmm. So some things we've held, you know, a lot of us have handled our business behind closed doors. And but I know that was the beginning when we started having meetings about harassment. We didn't take it very seriously because we were in newsrooms that were tough. We say things to each other. We'd probably all be in some kind of court because of mm-hmm. half the things we said. We just didn't think that way. I mean, it was like, hey, girl, you got wheels over there. And I'd say, thanks, buddy. You know, it was just a different kind of world, I think, in New York City back before things were so, I don't want to say politically correct or whatever, but it was just a different kind of world then.
I'm talking to Rolanda Watts today on the state of things. Well, talk about today now. Now that things have emerged and you have a chance to look back, I mean, I'm not asking you to second guess yourself or your colleagues, but what do you make of the movement today? Long time coming, and do you think that, it'll have some impact?
Yeah, I do think it's a long time coming, and I think that it has impact on all of us. I mean, I think a lot of us have seen it here and there. We've experienced it here and there. But I don't think we had any idea of how rampant it was and on such a high level. There's always been the casting couch in Hollywood. That's nothing new. In fact, that's part of, I mean, the casting couch is sometimes as iconic as Star Wars. Yeah. You know, we know about that casting couch. But when we see it and we see the level, when you see the power in a Weinstein, the power in a Matt Lauer, the power in a Bill O'Reilly, a power in a Bill Cosby, my God, that's something worth talking about, as we say. And that's not just, my concern is for the young lady out there in Piscataway that nobody's hearing about being brutalized at the auto repair shop. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That they aren't always the big stars, but thank goodness they had the courage to come out and set this record on its ear, because this is the year of the woman, and there's a lot we need to talk about because we have such tremendous leadership, and I think there's so many negative things happening that only positivity can come out of this. New leadership, new ways of looking at things, and new ways of protecting each other.
Well, and especially because it suggests to us all now that this isn't normal. I mean, what you're talking about is, you know, in that generation that you were coming up, it felt normal to you, and now we realize it's not. So at the very least, it sort of breaks that image and that illusion that that's okay, right?
Right. And it also, it gives, I mean, I can think back at a couple of things where I wanted to say, don't ever say that to me again. That is so uncool. And maybe there were times I could say that without feeling the repercussions, because newsrooms are a different kind of workplace than other places. But
let me stop you there. They're not off the hook, right? I mean, they're not.
Oh, no.
Right.
No.
I mean, it's not as though everybody else has to play by that rule. But harassment's okay in a newsroom. You're not saying that.
No, I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that we're a tough crowd. And yeah. And I, back in the day, I can remember some tough things we said to each other that probably are not politically correct today. I will say that. I will admit that. But on the level of whether it affected a career, I didn't see that. That's just my, that's just my experience. Mm-hmm. But I can best believe that any woman on this earth has felt this at some time. And I think that's been shocking, maybe to men or to other women who haven't experienced it. But I think it is something that is worth talking about because people's lives have deeply been affected. Now, just not the victim. Now, maybe if you're in a workplace and some guy keeps dropping some bomb, and you have to pull him aside and say, dude, get your head together. Maybe this is a time where we pull each other, because I don't think a lot of people know what harassment is.
Well, hopefully we're tuning in now, and we're tuning into Rolando Watts. We're going to take you to Hollywood after this break and talk about your career there and what you're doing today. Rolando Watts, successful journalist, talk show host, and author of the book Destiny Lingers. We'll continue our conversation on the state of things right after this. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Rolando Watts today. Those in the Triad may remember her early days at WFMY TV News. From there, off to anchor news in New York City, and then really gained national acclaim with her popular TV talk show. Rolanda has since written a book. Well, let's go to L.A. What brought you out to Los Angeles, Rolanda?
Well, you know, I had done so much in New York City, you know, between the talk show and Inside Edition and all the news. I was looking to tell stories in a new way. Of all the different things I do, whether it's the voiceovers or writing the books or news or talk shows, it's all storytelling. And I was looking for a new vehicle and came to Hollywood and have been telling stories from sitcoms to voiceovers. And, you know, one of my favorite jobs, I have to tell you, is being Professor Wiseman on Curious George.
We didn't even mention that yet.
People get such a kick out of it because I think, you know, it's like 100 years old, so many generations can relate to it. But it's also, you know, educating kids. We're really, really excited about that. But it's, I was looking for new ways to tell. And here's the other thing, too. I always wanted to be an actor. In fact, I majored in theater arts at Spelman, and with a double major in English and theater arts. And back then, when I got out of Spelman in 1980, my goodness, there weren't roles for people who looked like me. I mean, Spike Lee was in school with me. The Cosby Show hadn't come out. And I, you know, so thank God my so-called backup plan was to fall in love with journalism at Columbia. I remember telling my dad, and many parents can relate to this. I remember telling my dad once I got to Columbia, I said, Dad, we're sitting in this diner in Times Square. And I said, Dad, I am not really here to be a journalist. I'm really here to be on Broadway. And as soon as I get my role, I'm quitting journalism school. And I remember my dad looked at me. And he took this long, back then you could smoke in places. He took this long draw off his cigarette. And he looked at me and he said, good luck, little girl. I went to one cattle call and that cleared that up.
That's it. Back to television,
right? Thank God I fell in love with journalism. So it's been a good journey. But I came out here to tell stories, movies and films and acting, making that dream come true. And I think all of us have that little kid in us that still wants to do that thing they wanted to do. And I say, just like Dr. Maya Angelou said, don't die with that story still in you. I never wanted to be 80 years old rocking on a porch going, you know what? I could have done it. I could have been in a contender. You know, I wanted to, if I fall on my face, so what? Just get up and do something else.
Well, tell us
but
about
I don't want to say I didn't try it.
You did try and you succeeded. The Rolanda Show, the name for you, was a talk show. Talk a little bit about how the idea came about, because that's a form. So I think that was probably the peak of daytime TV talk shows, too, in terms of the number and the quality of shows back in the 1990s. What was the inspiration for that?
It was unbelievable how many talk shows there were.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all, there had to be 50 of them. Because I know the when I came out, there were just scores of shows that were out there. Roger King, who was the chairman, he still to this day, even from heaven, remains the most sellingest human being on earth in television. He did Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy, Inside Edition, Oprah Winfrey, The Rolanda Show. I could go on and on and on. But he wanted me to do a show. He was trying to get me to do a show for 5 years before I agreed to do it. Dumb me. but I was a journalist. I didn't do talk shows. Yeah. And he said, Rolanda, you have so much more to say than in a minute and 30 seconds, please. So I said, I'm not sure. So he said, well, come work on Inside Edition. So I went to Inside Edition, worked over there as an anchor woman, and worked with Bill O'Reilly, as a matter of fact, and traveled all over the world covering great stories. And 9 months into the job, he came into the studio, and he goes, I said, what do you want? He goes, Rolanda, I need you to do a talk show. I said, Roger. He goes, listen, will you do a favor for a friend? He was producing another show that wasn't doing well, and he didn't want to lose his time slot. And so I said, he said, you're great at live TV. I need you to in there like in 2 weeks. I said, 2 weeks? He goes, you know, most shows have a pilot. They go a year, year and a half to figure out what the show is. He goes, no, I need you in there in 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks, Frank, we were on the air.
Wow. Because in TV, it's 2 weeks to just get your makeup, isn't it? I mean, I haven't been in TV, but it feels
at
like.
At least.
Yeah.
But we were, and I can remember I would go and do my hosting on Inside Edition, unplug that microphone and cross the hall in the studio to the Rolanda show. I was doing two shows at one time, two national shows. But I tell you what, sometimes people see in you what you don't see in yourself.
Yeah. Well, let me say, I'm going to tell you, because I was teaching at the time. So I had left NPR and I was teaching a school that we'd founded in Washington, D.C. I had seventh graders. And they were always talking about you, your name. And Oprah would come up now and then. But Rolanda came up more often when I was teaching back in the 90s.
Oh,
and so
nice.
What I would do is I would actually illegally tape those shows and then show them in class. And you became our teaching moment. You were like our model for storytelling and fact checking and all that kind of stuff. But I want to play a clip from the show to talk a little bit about the ethos from the show, because you've been to New York and now you're in Hollywood, but you never lost your roots. So I'm going to play a clip from the Rolanda show. Here we go.
Oh, God.
Do you think, Rolanda, that black women and white women can really be good friends? My answer automatically, without question, absolutely, absolutely. That's just my experience. Maybe it's because some of my longest, deepest friendships have been with women, black and white, but a lot of white women as well. Maybe it's because when I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, my family was the only black family in the neighborhood. Maybe it's because when I went to my prep school, I was only black, not just in class, in the entire school. But I didn't feel the racial prejudice. I made very, very dear, dear, deep friendships that I still keep to this day.
That's a clip from the Rolanda Show. Rolanda Watts is my guest this hour. So what was, I mean, obviously you get thrown into the thing. You talked about King World Productions, it being their idea. But what did you bring to it, and how did you see that show as you began to shape it around some of the ideas? And again, some of the notions you had about around storytelling.
Well, I think that the power of our show is that we listened. We just didn't talk. We listened to people. And I think that's why we had such a tremendous amount of 14-year kids.
Yeah.
The 14 and 15-year-olds. And let me tell you something. I want to tell you, first of all, thank you so much. What an honor. And I'm humbly thankful. Thank you so much, Frank, for telling me that. There's a young man who's a Karamo Brown. He's about to come out with this show called Queer Eye, one of these shows where they redo you and stuff. But he told me, because we did a lot of commentary on HLN together, and he said, you know something? He said, I wanted to tell you this. He goes, I was 14 years old, and I was a little gay boy, and I felt like I didn't fit in anywhere. And he goes, and I would watch your show, and you made me feel like I did fit somewhere. Mm. And I said, and look at you today. You're a beautiful 30-something old with your own show now because you're a proud gay man. And I said, you know, we helped kids not kill themselves back then when people weren't talking about being gay, and it's very difficult for families. But being in a family with a gay brother, I wanted to bring that experience and talk about it. You know, I used my show to talk about race. I had the Grand Wizard of the KKK on my show and Skinheads because I wanted to use that time as an hour of power, something worth talking about. And really, we got the first exclusive interview with Tonya Harding. We were the only show she would speak with 3 months after the incident with Nancy Kerrigan. So we were the only talk show with a seat in the O.J. Simpson trial. And I really believe it was the journalism in me and the compassion that I have for people's stories without ambushing them. You don't have to embarrass people to tell a good story. And I think it was our integrity that held that brand, the Rolanda brand, and also the show. My producers went on to work for 2020, for The View, for major organizations because of the integrity of our show. And that's why we had to, after four seasons, quite frankly, say, we can't compete with Jerry Springer. We won't be part of this mess. And I left $1,000,000,000 on that table. Mm. But I still have my dignity and I have my integrity and a chance to do another one. So,
well, and maybe the landscape has changed forever. I want to talk with you about that. And yeah, again, the competitive pressures to become more like Jerry Springer. And so you either fit in or move out. But you had your time when you had an impact. Now things have changed dramatically. But before I get your thoughts on where we are today, I want to get you to talk more about your career, because now you're doing comedy as well, right?
Oh, my gosh, I'm having so much fun with this. I'm doing stand-up comedy. I've got two shows coming up if you're in L.A., one at the J Spot on February 15th, and then at the world-famous Comedy Store, where I'm pretty much a regular over there,
well,
on Sunset Boulevard. That's on the 23rd of February. And you can always catch up on social media at Rolonda Watts, or go to Rolonda.com. And that's R-O-L-O-N-D-A, and you can find out what I'm doing. But I just have a great time with it. Again, it's another form of storytelling that it keeps me really sharp with my comedy and timing and writing. But I'm having a ball with it. Kim Coles, who also has Winston-Salem roots.
Didn't know that.
And Jack A. Harry, who also has Winston-Salem roots. And you know who else out here who has Winston-Salem roots?
Who's that?
Is Angela Bassett.
Really?
Yeah. All of those
ladies.
Oh,
no, she went to school. She went to the school, didn't she?
She spent summers there. I think she had an aunt who taught over with my dad at Winston-Salem State.
There you go.
But Kim said, get on that stage, and I wouldn't do it. She said, you told me you wanted to do this, and I'm getting married, and I want it as a gift.
You're talking a lot about, I'm sorry, I interrupted this.
Sorry,
go ahead.
It's okay.
That's
no, I was just saying that Kim Coles dared me to get up on stage. I did it and fell in love, and now look what she created.
There you go. Well, and you talk a lot about being, let us say, you said you're 58 years old,
yeah,
unmarried, and that's a lot of what you talk about, right?
Yeah, I was married before. I was married for a long, long, long time, 3 years.
It's the long 3 years. Here's what I'm going to do. We're coming up against a break. I'm going to play a clip right now, some of the stuff you're doing, and then
okay,
we'll come back and we'll talk more about it. But here's a little bit of one of your routines.
I've been waiting around for Mr. Right for so long, I've become the man I wanted to marry. And I'm serious. If you really think about it, I do all the things around my house I think a good man needs to be doing, like paying the mortgage, taking the dog and the trash out at night. I mean, I'm the one who goes and checks out those strange little bumps in the night. I'm the one who takes me on exotic vacations. I'm the one who takes me out on romantic dinners and buys me a bottle of wine. I'm even the one who has great sex with myself.
There we go. Rolonda Watts, our guest today on The State of Things. So you're the president of Sex Without Partners? Is that what you're
saying?
Listen,
and let me tell you something. I listen, and I take my time.
When did you start? How long have you been wanting to do this? I mean, obviously people are pushing you to the stage, but that meant that they heard something funny. When did it occur to you that this would be a cool thing to do?
Well, you know what's so funny is that back in the day when I was a theater arts major at Spelman College, my specialty was comedy. You know, comedy is the hardest form of theater. And I just found it just so wonderful. There's nothing better in the world than to get people to laugh. It just is a wonderful, magical thing. Now, I'm not saying every one of my jokes is funny. It depends. But I sure am having fun, and I keep getting asked back, so there must be something there. But I think it's just a wonderful, if you can get it going and get people laughing and talk about things in a funny way. Because really what's funny is the truth. You know, it's just the true stuff. And my whole routine, my set right now, is about being a woman of a certain age, cyber dating. I mean, that's just so different from what we do.
How's it going for you?
Well, I'm working on it.
Because you've talked about just the troubles of being that age. And you also have been quite open about the fact that you really love, like, younger men.
Well, now I do have a little cougar-licious streak.
You said cougar, right? Go ahead.
A cougar. You're right. That. But when you start, here's the thing. When I moved out to L.A., they were telling me that I was like the new hot Hollywood cougar. They were calling me the Black Demi Moore. And I learned the worst thing you can do is believe your own PR. And started collecting tenderonis. And you know you're in trouble when you find out you got blouses and pantsuits older than them. And then when they move in, they're so cute. They change their Facebook status to retired. It's like, when did I go from being a hot Hollywood cougar to feeling like a saber-toothed tiger with a credit card? Just somebody tell me when this happened. It's just...
You're going to have to look up. If you don't know what cougar is and you're a little bit lost, you're just going to have to go look it up. But it has to do with a woman of a certain age who is attractive to men of a much younger age. Something
well,
like that.
Well, you know, but it's crazy because the 30-year-olds love you. But, you know, they want the same thing from you they want from their mother.
Well, that's the thing. 30-year-old men today still need their mother, and that's part of the deal.
Right. They want money and boobs. That's what they want.
Hey, what's next? So we've got the book. We've got Destiny Lingers, the novel that you wrote. We've got the talk show career, the news career, now comedy. What's next? You're not done.
Well, no. You know, my readers really want a sequel. They want to know what Chase and Destiny are going to do now. And I can hear the characters talking to me, so that will come in down the line future. But in the meantime, I'd like to turn Destiny Lingers into a screenplay. And I also have the rights to a wonderful story from Winston-Salem, actually, about a young woman who helped kick off the labor movement that I'm working on a script for as well. In talk, I'm getting approached to do another talk show, which I'm very excited about. And I got a sitcom pilot I'm going to be working on this spring. So 2018 is going to be good. I would love to come and travel around and to bring some comedy and laughter to wherever you are and to talk about my book. I'm open to book clubs. See, today is so cool because I can Skype in with your book clubs today.
If it gets too much for you in LA, I got a couple extra mics here in this studio. Could use a co-host, and I think I could work it out.
Listen, don't you tell me that, because I'm always looking for a hot mic.
Too bad. My name is Frank. Rolando Watts, a journalist, talk show host, and an actress, now an author. The new book, Destiny Lingers. What a pleasure, Rolando Watts. So good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
So great to talk with you, too. And go get a barbecue sandwich on me.
We'll do it. You can find out more about our show, her book, and everything we've talked about at our website, stateofthings.org, a program that's produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brookland, Robert Kinlaw, Angie Perrin, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.